Hey, it's Chris from Charity Digital, and welcome to the very first Charity Digital podcast. Thanks for joining us. We're really excited to get this up and running, and we look forward to bringing you some insightful discussions over the next few months. As we're new to the podcast world, please bear with us. Our first few recordings may experience the odd sound issues here and there, but we promise it does get better after that. We hope you enjoy the pod, and please don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe through your usual podcast provider.
Hello, welcome to the Charity Digital Podcast. There's been increasing discussion on diversity and inclusion in the charity sector, highlighted by campaigns like hashtag CharitySoWhite.
This was a discussion between people of colour about their experiences as POC in charities and how their experience is shaped by racial bias that exists in wider society.
We use lots of terminology in this podcast, which is changing and fluid. We use terms like BAME, POC, and we use black and brown people. We use them quite interchangeably. And Rabi's going to talk about why we use some of these terms.
Okay, so if you go online, the internet is abuzz with information about these terms. Having looked online, we found that generally the term BAME has more of a legal sort of history connected with it. And it's a kind of term you might think of as a catch-all used to describe people who are black, Asian and minority ethnic. It puts everyone together in a group that is useful maybe for things like legal structures and processes, but lacks a bit of individual nuance, which is why terms like people of colour are useful, because that has more of a kind of individual association with it that you might use to identify yourself against this wider background of sort of BAME terminology. We also use terms like black and brown people to make the conversation even more individual and directly relevant to our own experiences as within the BAME communities. A black person's experiences would differ widely from the experiences of a brown person.
Exactly. So because there's so many words and so many ways to refer to yourself, we do use them interchangeably, and we don't have a set idea of what is the best word to use, but we use the word that we feel makes most sense at the time. My name is Sushi and I'm the host of this podcast today. I'm joined by Rabia Fasil, who's the Customer Support Manager and Content Writer at Charity Digital and has worked here for 9 years. Hello.
Hi.
And I'm joined by Colette Philip-Keane, who is the founder and managing director of a brand and strategy consultancy called Brand By Me.
Hello. We had a really interesting discussion. There was lots to cover, and I'm sure there's loads of other things we could have explored. But my most interesting takeaway was the discussion around allyship, because I think when you hear conversations around people of colour, when you're discussing issues around diversity, if you're not someone who would be, who's not a person of colour, who's not LGBT, who's not disabled, you might find yourself struggling to think about how to engage in this conversation. And I think that is something that we want to bring you into, we want you to be part of, and there is a way to connect and there is a way to discuss and get involved in it. And I think it's vital that you're part of it, actually. So I think that's why I think it's really interesting. I hope the listeners at home will be excited and want to get involved, basically. So that was my interesting takeaway, that allyship is possible. Colette, what was your interesting takeaway?
I think it comes back to what we were saying. I mean, I endorse that. Allyship is possible, encouraged, and actually using podcasts like this to help people understand the lived experiences of people of colour, so that when you hear it, you can empathise, not seek to defend, but empathise and really absorb and take that on. The other thing was the reflections on shared experience of people of colour and women of colour. And I think the power of this conversation, just it always seeks to reinforce our experiences individually. They might look different, but there are some very coherent themes that come across and some very sort of clear obstacles that might manifest itself differently. So I think my key takeout, and I guess one of the things is, like, yes, there is shared experience here, do not let the fact that those shared experiences manifest differently stop us from being able to understand that it is a shared collective experience and that we can support each other in this, because that's really important.
There's a whole episode in that, really, isn't there?
I would definitely sort of agree and expand on sort of both of your sort of key takeaways. The idea around allyship is crucial to me. I think it's so important that the conversation becomes a conversation and a dialogue in the truest sense. So it's the people with the shared experiences who've been able to connect with one another, and then sort of, you know, having conversations with those of us who are not from these backgrounds, or, you know, are excluded, I don't know, who face issues around inclusivity. I think it's so important to recognise that. And I think one of the key takeaways is sort of how ultimately talking about the issues that we face, talking about our shared experiences, enriches our work within the sector and ultimately helps us to enrich the work of the organisations that we work for and that we work with. So how we can use our shared experiences productively to kind of channel back into progressing the work of the sector itself largely, so that organisations are not stagnating, organisations remain as agile and as fresh as they were upon conception, and they can continue to do the sort of good work that have brought us to this stage. So I'd say my key takeaway is that a tentative sense of hope and optimism, I think, for the sector.
Okay, hang on, let's stop there before we give it all away. Let's get started.
Thanks for joining us both today. So, we're going to talk about some of your experiences working in the charity sector and how you have, what you've seen, what's been interesting, shocking, surprising for you. So, Colette, would you be willing to share some of the things that you've experienced?
Yes, so I now run my own business, which I've done for 3 years. But before that, I guess over my 17-year career, I've sort of flipped between commercial and charity sector. I spent 10 years in advertising, which although was a brilliant experience, thinking about what we're talking about today, being paid in the advertising industry, tough. And then I got my dream job at Barnardo's, the children's charity, as head of brand and digital, and then I was promoted to assistant director of comms. And that experience, from an organisational point of view, just looking at even what Barnardo's were doing back then, I don't know what it's like now because I don't work there anymore, haven't done for about 10 years, but looking at how they were seeking to tackle inclusion and how they understood that inclusion was a core part of the mission and values of the charity was one, inspirational, and also brilliant to be a part of. I think because the charity was so maybe ahead of its time, I think some of the things we now know about integrating things like staff networks and inclusion groups into charity decision making or listening structures, maybe there were some issues around that, and certainly it didn't prevent the sort of daily microaggressions you get just for being a person of colour working in any number of industries. But that was a very positive experience organisationally, but ultimately still led to the same kind of burnout from working kind of too hard to prove yourself and get to a certain place. Then I went back to commercial sector a little bit before joining another charity to run a global rebrand. And there, again, it's hard, we were talking about this, because I don't want to give the impression that my experiences have been wholly negative, because they haven't. I love my career, I love working in brand strategy, I love working with charities, yeah. And the combination of all those things has been quite brilliant. Yeah. That being said, I know that at times I can see where I've been held back. I certainly have always hit a ceiling, and I've had to bounce out of the organisation industries and effectively just set up my own thing to achieve the potential that I know that I'm capable of. And looking across the balance of my career, I know that there's experiences that I can only put down to race. So for example, I went for a very senior role, charity adjacent, so a mix of charity and commercial. I got down to the final one. There was only me, no one else, literally the final one. met the board, and then they told me that I wasn't assertive enough for the role. Problem being, of course, that's just not true and that's not me. And then looking subsequently at who went on and hired a succession of, middle-aged white males to do the same role, who bounced out of the role because it was quite complex, whereas my experience, and I guess I had to get very comfortable with understanding that sometimes when they say not you, you have to not take it in, and that was an example of it, I guess. So I don't know if that's helped. That's kind of my experience. Yes, positive from a subject matter and purpose point of view.
Yeah.
But, you know, I heard it referenced as the sort of doing business while black, and that is something, I can speak to my lived experience as a black woman. There is just a layer of challenge that you have. It's like fighting through mud or something that just makes it that much more challenging to do your everyday job. And what's great though now is that I guess the environment and things like where people are able to speak out and the charity So White sort of hashtag, it allows people to share experiences. So people, even if they're not lived experiences, people get it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take people having lived experiences for people to understand this is an issue and want to try and help. And that's a big deal because, when I started my career in kind of early noughties, I was going, lived experience, you were meant to feel like this is just you and this is a problem for you and it's probably because you're not good enough because we're a meritocracy and that sort of thing. And that's a very different, it's moved on loads since then. And I think it will only, I'm an optimist, I think it will only seek to get better if we continue to do great stuff like this, where we're able to start talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. I think what's really interesting, you just said about the idea that there is a ceiling point, and that is something that I've heard so many times from people of colour, which is really shocking. And I think it's difficult because you cannot distinguish between whether it is you or your environment, and you're constantly living in that battle.
Absolutely.
Constantly wondering if you could have done anything better because you are just yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So I can completely understand that view and hear it, and it's really frustrating that there's no answer because you can't go back to that person and say, did you not hire me because I'm a person of colour? There's no way to do that.
And also people wouldn't answer.
No, of course
people would not answer. Many majority of people would not answer, honestly, because actually sometimes bias is unconscious. The thing, actually, what does help that though is two things. It's looking back in, so we talked about this, but I am talking about experiences that 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, because it takes a time to have that sort of objectivity to look back. The other thing that helps that though is collective shared experiences. Because if it's you hitting that ceiling, you might think, well, maybe it's because of an issue. If you see, you're in an organisation, you see everybody hitting that ceiling that's of person of colour, that can't be all of you. That can't be. That's just not a thing. So actually, the power of collective experiences and coming together and finding safe spaces where we can have conversations around this stuff and then agree set of actions or at least debate it amongst ourselves, that's useful, because then actually you have sort of a body of evidence and share, and then when it becomes shared experience, it takes on a life of its own. It then becomes more difficult for people to say, well, that's just you. Or, and I think the other big thing around that ceiling is, and this is a big issue, so there's two things around the myth of meritocracy, which I read a really good article on about actually meritocracy. It was set up to help address disadvantage and help influence inclusion, but what it's actually ended up doing is reinforcing a privilege. Because actually people, you can see where people say they operate meritocracy is obviously, certainly from an economic disadvantage point of view, like the people that are getting the good grades are the ones who have come from my affluent background. It just reinforces that after a point. So whereas at first it just doesn't work anymore, where people, so-called meritocracy just doesn't work. However, there's that. I think that that shared experience thing is just absolutely massive in helping us understand and sort of break down that barriers and maybe understand, that ceiling's happening to everybody. There has to be an issue here, and getting people to see that is it can be quite powerful.
Definitely.
Hi, I'm Rabia from Charity Digital. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. As part of carrying on the dialogue of inclusivity in the sector, we want to highlight some of the Black, Asian and minority ethnic charity employees that are championing change, leadership and digital transformation. To nominate a friend or colleague, please head over to charitydigital.org.uk/inclusion.
And Rabia, what's your experience been in the charity sector?
My experience within the sector has been not to kind of echo Colette's views, has been largely similar, so overall more positive than not. And it's been the case that, you know, you are recognised for your skills and your abilities, you're given tasks, roles accordingly. But what, listening to you talk about sort of, you know, the idea of a ceiling, I agree wholeheartedly with that. What I've found is there's a ceiling, and sometimes the ceiling feels a little bit like a box. So what happens is you have your education or your abilities or your experiences that you bring to particular roles or tasks, and they are very much recognised within the moment and they are very much lauded within the moment. But when that moment has passed, when what you at the receiving end unfortunately start to view as your expediency, is that after that you're kind of expected to slot back quite comfortably into your box. And there's a perception that if you are not willing to go along with this kind of shifting nature of your, how you're perceived and, you know, your flexibility that you've brought, then that somehow is a reflection on you and that you're, you know, not sort of being a team player as you were. And it's like, as Colette said, it's mostly been quite positive. It's been very gratifying to be recognised for the skills and abilities I've brought. But it's very much that sort of sense of moments when you're useful, and then sort of, whereas you might consider that your counterparts would be recognised for their skills and abilities, and then that might pave the way for a kind of upward progression. And that upward progression looks both like economic progression and sort of a, you know, your standing status, is that the right sort of word, within the organisation. So I found that that's something across the sector has kind of happened a little bit, and the extremely high value of talking about the shared experience, it's so important for us to connect and talk about what we've sort of been through, from the kind of daily, small kind of microaggressions that we might encounter to these kind of larger trends. And it helps us sort of identify what's going on. Because one of the biggest things I find, and as I'm sure we've all probably found within the room, is that you have particular experiences, and then there's that constant sense of, is it just me? And it's just so useful, and it's such a relief to kind of speak to people who kind of sit down and talk to you about very similar things, and you find yourself thinking, oh, I wasn't, you know, it's, this is unfortunate, this is real. But as you say, you know, projects such as this are so enormously productive and useful to guide the conversation as we move forward in terms of recognizing what has been happening to people and kind of identifying ways in which we can redirect the narrative so that in the decades to follow, these things can be either eradicated or redirected into more useful channels.
I love that idea of redirecting the narrative, because I think redirecting, maybe even, and broadening the narrative too, beyond the certain, and broadening in a couple of ways, but some of the themes we talk about, but even also the people that are able to have and participate too, which I think are really important. One thing, building on what Rabia's just said, I think it's funny, the ceiling, the box, at times it feels like a sphere where you can run around in it. You like those balls that you can run around in. Something like a hamster wheel, so you go around and you come back to the same place again. There's a number of things, but very much constricting structures. I think the biggest constriction though is, because yes, while you're useful, when you look to extend out of that box, that sphere, people who, what the experience of people of colour, and certainly Black women that I've spoken to, will tell you that actually there's a common theme in terms of people look for reasons not to give you opportunities. So they're looking for reasons not to. So natural negatives, they'll use as reasons not to. Whereas for your counterparts, your peers that have, you know, faces, experiences that fit. So when I worked in advertising, that might be males, private education,
yes.
Oxbridge Good Uni.
Yeah.
They will be given, they'll actively look for reasons to and discount the negative. And that's what I found the biggest thing looking at my peers. My feedback was always the reasons why we're not going to do this. People who are promoted and lauded, it's the reasons they're actively looking for one reason, and they just propel those people forward. And I guess that's the difference. I mean, that is an unconscious thing. People won't recognise they're doing it.
Yes.
And that's something, and that was something that took, that was something where actually shared experience and sharing experiences helped me understand that. A really big point. And then it also helped me call that out where that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in closed spaces.
Yes, yeah.
Because I said, the feedback I'm not assertive is certainly not true. Sometimes the opposite is true. So I was frequently speak out and whoop. Probably needed to say it differently because that has just come across so strong. But actually, it's out there now, so let's just run with it. So yeah, I think that sort of very subtle realization is something that can only come when we share experiences. And an acknowledgement that it looks different. It's not, you know, the collective word BAME is often problematic. I mean, it's hard because we do have some shared experiences.
Yeah.
So there's times when we can talk about ourselves as a collective, because we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the term women of colour is the same thing.
Yes.
There are some shared, very shared experiences. But equally, it is problematic from an outside point of view, saying, you know, the people with a funny tinge.
Yeah.
Another
yeah.
way to say that, you
yeah.
know, it's that, it does invite,
yeah.
it sort of plays into that, and it is problematic. So I guess an acknowledgement and understanding that shared experience, understanding the different and subsets of experiences within that, so that we don't inadvertently bump up against each other or, you know, trying to create some collective sense of community within that. Which, again, stuff like this really helps
yeah.
do. We talked about tribe
yes.
and that sense of community.
Yeah.
Within the tribe, we might have discussions amongst ourselves, they might disagree with, but actually that sense of community and tribe, I think, is really, really important when we're talking in this space.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about this idea that you need to be able to express things in a shared collective mm-hmm. voice almost.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you do that when you are the only brown or black person in the organisation?
When you are the only black, brown, etc.
mm-hmm.
sort of person within the organisation, you don't necessarily want to put yourself forward
mm-hmm.
because I'm just kind of hypothetically, if I was in this person's situation, if I was to sort of talk about, you know, possibly needing a prayer room, and sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, you kind of find yourself thinking, once you have, you know, talked about a particular thing that is unique to your heritage or identity, I found that sometimes what happens as a result is I end up becoming the kind of unintentional expert on
yes.
that particular
yeah.
thing. So then what happens is you sort of, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you might want a prayer room, and then sort of anything of any vaguely Muslim interest you are the expert on. You are the
support.
Yes, you
oh.
are the person to give forth advice.
Speak
you are
the community.
You
yes,
do.
Yes.
You have to have an answer for
yeah.
why.
And if you don't know, then you're not an expert anymore.
And
yes.
if you've not heard of this, well, why not? You know,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And you can't really
talk about it.
This
it can't
thing.
Be you anymore.
No.
You have to be this mouthpiece
no.
for the community. I mean, this is where the power of allyship comes in.
This is it.
Because I think, you know, I am not a trans woman. But I understand the importance and the impact from speaking to people of misgendering people, of not making assumptions. And I've had to learn that over time. It's not something I grew up with as a kid, or because my lived experience was being like, you know, I think the power of allyship and taking ownership and responsibility, no matter who we are,
yeah.
for being and is really powerful. So if you see people as the lone voices, they shouldn't have to speak up alone.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't have to be the only one speaking up. They should. There should be, and it is worth encouraging and looking for like minds.
Yes.
That may not be skin folk who can actually help and amplify and speak up on your behalf at times.
Yeah.
This is also where organisations You know, this is where things like policy and guidance come in. So where organisations outside your own should be consulting with, you know, diversity for office moves, for example, there's guidance that exists. If you look around and look at this stuff, it's a leadership responsibility. So I don't think it's not on the sole lone face to be speaking up alone. It's really unfair. Oh, and you know, even if they are paid extra to be mouthpiece of the BME rep or something, even if they're paid extra, so I think it's incredibly unfair and they shouldn't be given that role. It is on the onus of leaders to do their job properly, to be allies, and to actually consult widely enough so you can take into account the different needs of being a genuinely inclusive organisation might look like. And, you know, it's not always you're going to get it right, but when you do get it wrong, then quickly make amends and find a way. Don't be, oh well.
That's so sort of true, especially because it's then the kind of the focus changes, I feel, in such a productive and useful way. You go from, you know, expecting, if you put the onus on the individual, it becomes sort of Rabia's issue, or it becomes, you know, this person's issue. Whereas if we look at things like policy and guidance, it's a structural issue. And that's so much more useful. You visit, you know, hospitals, you visit schools, these spaces are built to accommodate the needs of the people who will be using these spaces. And I think it's so valuable to kind of perceive it from that side of things as a kind of structural issue.
Exactly.
And infrastructure.
Exactly. I take it very seriously, diversity and inclusion, from running a brand and strategy consultancy and doing my bit beyond just this. So where companies have values that talk about it, I will ask them, we'll build it in, you know, looking at how we can do this, calling out stuff. I take, you know, a 360 degree role to this stuff beyond just my lived experiences of being a black woman. And I think that, so for example, in this case, the firm helping you with the office move will have some guidance. They should flag it. Their trade body should have it. You know, there should be any number of places where people are hearing these guidelines. That is the case for, and even then it's not great, but when we look at disability and inclusion around disability, that's the case. People get pressure from a number of sides. They get pressure, and I think that's a similar approach. You know, positive pressure, it's not, you know, negative, but actually pressure and then guidance, how-tos, help if you can't do this, and pragmatic steps too.
Yeah. I think there's almost the fear, like you touched on it, this idea that if you get something wrong, then rectify it. There's a fear of getting things wrong, and that's kind of inhibiting people from even doing
the first steps. Yeah. But isn't that unacceptable, particularly looking at the subject of this podcast there, we're called Charity Digital, looking at the space of digital and how we, you know, move beyond agile into just iterative working. It is that fail fast, do things wrong, mistakes are how you learn.
Yeah.
That is good practice now for leadership. So you can't, but you know, if you are using that as an excuse, because it's interesting, some very forward-thinking organisations will use this as an excuse, specifically around this topic. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to buy that, because actually, in modern leadership, we're encouraged as leaders to really make sure that we don't punish people for mistakes, that mistakes are how we learn, to really do that. That's just a part of this.
Yes.
That's just a part of this. Yeah. And also then, as a community and tribe, we have to acknowledge that people will get it wrong, and we hold them accountable, but we also recognise that.
Mm-hmm.
So we give them a chance to make amends and come back, and then we'll work with you.
I think that's a great place to end part one. Thank you, Rabia and Colette, for joining us today. Join us for part two, where we'll explore what can happen when organisations are not prepared for the challenges around inclusion.
Hi, I'm Rabia from Charity Digital. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. As part of carrying on the dialogue of inclusivity in the charity sector, we want to champion some of the Black, Asian and minority ethnic charity employees that are championing change, leadership and digital transformation. To nominate a friend or colleague, please head over to www.charitydigital.org.uk/inclusion. Thank you!